If they have a good personality and they're not great looking, then who fucking cares?
Well, let's just say hypothetically, okay, what if they have a good personality? I know. There are no girls with good personalities.
Good personality consists of a chick with a little hard body who will satisfy all sexual demands without being too slutty about things and who will essentially keep her dumb fucking mouth shut.
The only girls with good personalities who are smart or maybe funny or halfway intelligent or talented, though God knows what the fuck that means, are ugly chicks.
Absolutely.
And this is because they have to make up for how fucking unattractive they are.
Do you know what Ed Gein said about women?
Ed Gein, Maitre d' Canal Bar?
No. Serial killer, Wisconsin in the 50s.
What did Ed say?
He said, when I see a pretty girl walking down the street, I think two things. One part of me wants to take her out and talk to her, be real nice and sweet and treat her right.
And what'd the other part of him think?
What her head would look like on a stick.
Episode 65 of the Cult of Matt Mark Cult Film Review Podcast. I'm Matt.
And I'm Mark.
Make sure to visit us at our blog at cultfilmreview.blogspot.com or shoot us an email at cultfilmreview@gmail.com. Show news. Actually, we do have some show news because there was big news this week.
What happened?
Well, regarding one of our segments on the show, Roger Ebert passed away at age 70.
Oh, he did. That was very sort of expected, I guess.
Well, it was strange because he had a press release that said he will be taking an absence of presence to undergo radiation treatment because his cancer reoccurred, and then kabam, dead. I mean, like a day or two later after that.
Well, it looks like he and his wife probably knew what was going on, and you know, when it gets down there to the end, it sort of sneaks up on you all of a sudden. You sort of maintaining.
Yeah.
Then it's just time for the lights to go out. It just sort of happens. One day you just go, shit, yeah, I guess this is it.
I guess you just give up the ghost as it were, and your will just fails you, and that's it, huh? And just
I think mind over matter. Will has a lot to do with whether you live or die. And, you know, you only can struggle for so long before it's time to go. And it's not so much you're resigned to it, but it's just, I think for a lot of people, it's the right thing to do. You sort of accept it.
Yeah. I don't know.
Don't worry. We'll all get the chance.
I know.
Unless we're killed in a vehicular accident.
It's a great part about life. We are all given those kind of opportunities. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
If you're lucky.
If you're lucky. Anyway, he will be missed, but our segment will go on because unless they pull all his reviews offline, which I doubt they do.
Yeah, we'll have to. If we do some really new ones, which I guess we don't normally do, for the really old stuff, we got Canby, who's passed.
Yeah.
And now we have for everything else, we have Ebert, at least for a while.
I enjoy Roper, to be honest, although he has video reviews online. I can't find his written stuff, or at least I don't look very hard. So I've always agreed. I always agreed with Roper far more than I did Gene, but just personal preference. Let's get on with the movie this week, which is the 2000, I'm going to call it a cult film. It's at least controversial film, American Psycho, starring one of my favorite actors, Christian Bale.
Well, he has a huge, huge pedigree.
Yeah, there's a lot of people up for the role. I think Leonardo DiCaprio was attached to the project at one time. Also, Ed Norton. Some folks that were in line to do it. But I think Christian Bale did it perfectly. And
well, I think you needed sort of a preening pretty boy. So I guess DiCaprio probably would be the second best choice.
Well, Christian Bale's a bit of a method actor, in my opinion, and especially when it comes to physically readying himself for a role. I think the starkest examples of that are probably The Machinist, where he basically went anorexic for I don't know how long to drop as much weight as he did, and Rescue Dawn, another Herzog movie, where he also dropped a ton of weight. And then there's this film where he just is amazingly cut. You know, I don't know. I think I read that he spent like 3 hours in the gym every day to get ready for this role.
He's very musculature. I mean, as much as he is in the Dark Knight movies.
Yeah. And what's strange about Christian Bale, and this is, it always catches me off guard, he has an amazing American accent. His American accent amongst British actors, I'd say, is probably second to none, to the point where I see him at like an award show, you know, receiving his award, and I can hardly understand him with his Welsh accent. It's like so thick and heavy. Yet for this role, it's perfect, flawless American accent. And I guess he sort of did some method acting, preparation by not speaking in his Welsh accent, even when the cameras weren't going. So offset, he would still keep it up, you know, to maintain it, I guess, so he wouldn't slip into his Welsh accent. But
it's very impressive.
Yeah. So let's get into the plot rundown. Bret Easton Ellis's dark and violent satire of America in the 1980s is brought to screen in this unsettling drama with blackly comic overtones. Patrick Bateman, played by Christian Bale, the son of a wealthy Wall Street financier, is pursuing his own lucrative career with his father's firm. Bateman is the prototypical yuppie obsessed with success, fashion, and style. He is also a serial killer who murders, rapes, and mutilates both strangers and acquaintances without provocation or reason. Donald Kimball, a police detective, questions Bateman about the disappearance of Paul Allen, whom Patrick murdered several days earlier. As Kimball stays on Bateman's trail, Bateman's mask of studied, distant cool begins to fall apart. American Psycho also features Reese Witherspoon as Bateman's girlfriend, as well as Samantha Mathis, Chloe Sevigny, and Guinevere Turner. So I didn't realize that was Chloe Sevigny until just the second watch. So,
oh yeah, I guess, I mean, she's a little bit younger, and she wears her hair down over her face, which I guess can maybe hide her a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. So,
but I thought that was a neat role as Jean. It was a bit of a character that didn't exist anywhere else in the film, where everybody else is sort of a, including Bateman and every other person in the film, really. It's just sort of, they're more concerned with themselves. They're sort of self-centered individuals, and seeing somebody, you know, sort of seems sort of Midwestern and honest and caring with Jean is an interesting flavor that sort of sets everything else off, I think.
Well, she's a bit of a, I guess, ambassador to Bateman's psychotic world, which is ambiguous, I would say that, especially with the final scene where it turns out that Paul Allen, which seems coincidental with the Microsoft founder, Paul Allen, that name.
It's a great name, though. It's just such a milquetoast, white bread name, Paul Allen.
Paul Allen he isn't actually murdered, so it's a bit of a tear in the delusions of the Bateman character. Although it's ambiguous because we have an unreliable.
Well,
narrator.
I can't. I've seen this movie maybe three times, and I really can't consider it ambiguous any longer. It seems pretty clear cut that these murders take place in the mind. Of Jason.
For starters,
Patrick, Jason, yeah, Bateman,
Jason Bateman. Is that, no? Wait a minute. What is that name? Jason Bateman. No,
that's the actor, Jason Bateman, yeah, from Arrested Development, and
right?
Various other projects.
So he murders, I don't know how many people in this film, but
20 or 40, as he says on the phone.
Well, there's the sort of. Was it the prostitutes running through? Is it his or Paul Allen's apartment? I can't forget. He's murdering people
Paul Allen's apartment in that scene. And you see all sorts of bodies around there. In fact, you see Jean's body in plastic at one point.
Really?
In the closet. Yeah.
I didn't even catch that. Well, yeah. That's a bit of a tell right there that it's all in his mind.
Yeah, it is. She's one of the bodies in the closet.
Okay. Well, all the murders are kind of fantastical.
They certainly are.
Like dropping a running chainsaw from five stories up and then having it like stab in the back somebody who is at the bottom of the landing seemed a little far-fetched.
Yeah, it's pretty fanciful. And the very next scene is him drawing that scene at the Crayon restaurant with Crayon.
Right, right. So all that, yeah. So I guess we can – but see, it's kind of funny. American Psycho – he's psychotically delusional I mean, either way, he's a little bit psychotic, right? He's psychotically delusional or psychotically homicidal.
Well, he has a serious mental problem. I mean, I always find the most interesting part of this film is he tries so hard to conform. I mean, with all the voiceover, which I think is very nice in this movie. Another plus on my campaign to, you know, stop the derision of the use of the voiceover. But the voiceover is excellent in this film. And he goes, I mean, there's a scene where basically just knocks you over the head right at the beginning where he's talking about his mask and there's no, and he's pulling off his facial mask and he's saying there's no such person as Patrick Bateman, an illusion.
Let me read that quote. It's a good quote. I have all the characteristics of a human being, blood, flesh, skin, hair, but not a single clear, indefinable emotion except for greed and disgust. Something horrible is happening inside of me, and I don't know why. My nightly bloodlust has overflown into my days. I feel lethal on the verge of frenzy. I think my mask of sanity is about to slip. Is that what you were talking about? Was that the quote?
Yeah, that's when he's pulling off that facial mask as he's talking about the illusion of himself.
Which I guess for the role, Christian Bale actually would go through that routine every morning. So he would do his 1,000 crunches. I don't know if he was doing it to pornography. And then
To axe murders.
Or to the Texas Chainsaw Murder.
Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Oh, that's right.
And then he would put all that.
You know, I thought it was weird that he said that he would let himself use a exfoliating rub with some alcohol. That's just crazy. You don't want to use any alcohol on your face. It dries it out.
That he mentions
next
that,
thing,
right?
You know, you're going to get rosacea. I know, but he said he'd use some alcohol. I don't know what he's talking about.
I don't know either. I don't do any facial prep. Do you do any facial prep in the morning?
Not on myself.
Oh, yeah. All right. Moving on. Okay. I do scrub my face with an overpriced bar soap that I bought at a Canadian retailer called Lush, which has probably some of the most aggressive floor people of any store I've ever been in. It's staffed with kind of manic gay men, and they come at you. Like, and before you know it, you have a basket filled with overpriced soaps, and you're just like, I got to get the fuck out of here. I don't know. It's quite the experience.
I'll tell you, a supermarket soap blows. Like, I'm not some sort of preening guy, but the soap you get, and then, you know, like the Dial and the Dove and all that shit. I think that's crap. You got to go to a nice store and get yourself a nice, like, olive oil-based soap without any fragrances in it. That's what I like.
Well, the detergent.
Like, Pré de Provence is a good brand. You should really use that if you can.
As long as it's not fucking Tom's Amine, that's all I got to say. That's the most ineffective shit that any company could ever. To be, like, nice to the earth, you've pretty much reduced its chemical potency to, I don't know, nothing. It's
well, I always like the fact that they make toothpaste without fluoride.
What the fuck's the point?
It still blows my mind that people are not interested in using low quantities of fluoride in their toothpaste.
Fucking brush your teeth with baking soda or something.
Well, these are the same people who don't like vaccinations.
Yeah, don't get me started on that shit.
Or people who don't use aluminum salts in their their antiperspirants.
Really?
It's the most effective antiperspirant. People don't like, for some reason, people hate aluminum salts. That's what they mean. It's all aluminum, you know, all your antiperspirants. That's the main active ingredient.
You know, this just gets me on my hippie hating terror. I don't want to get on, so we'll move on because those people drive me the fucking nuts. So let's talk about this film. I guess the. Well, okay. It seems like a metaphor. The entire. Jason Bateman. Bateman.
It's Patrick Bateman.
Patrick Bateman, right.
Think of like Jason Bateman, but put a leprechaun outfit on him, and then you'll say Patrick Bateman.
How to Patrick Bateman.
Right. Patrick Bateman here.
Terrible Irish accents. Anyway, so the impetus, it was a novel before it was a film, and to do some pathetic justice to Bret Easton Ellison's rationale for the movie. I think he was getting caught up in 80s materialism and felt some kind of I don't know, almost reaction, some sort of like soulful reaction to this, to the whole yuppie craze, and felt like he was sort of descending a bit into some kind of quasi madness about, you know, the consumerism here. And so he has a quote, Bateman was crazy the same way I was. He did not come out of me sitting down and wanting to write a grand sweeping indictment of yuppie culture. It initiated because of my own isolation and alienation at a point in my life. I was living like Patrick Bateman. I was slipping into a consumerist kind of void that was supposed to give me confidence and make me feel good about myself, but just made me feel worse and worse and worse about myself. That is where the tension of American psycho came from. So, I don't know. Can you relate to that?
Well, I guess it's the only thing, it's the only straw that Bateman has to grasp at. He doesn't understand people. So he's grasping at anything. So he has this extreme health regimen, because a lot of other people do it. He's interested in, vaguely, in sort of the social ladder of business. Not to actually do any business, mind you. The only reason he's employed is because his father is a major player in the company. It doesn't seem like he actually does any work.
Yeah, we don't actually see him do any work in the entire
thing. And I don't believe he does. I think he's just hired so his son has a decent...
He sits in his office and watches Jeopardy. You get that much.
And reads magazines.
Yeah.
And scribbles in his notebook.
Yeah, right.
But he's trying. He sees people behaving around him. He tries to imitate it. I mean, the most obvious thing where he imitates how people is... His use of music, I guess. Yeah. And we're sort of getting off topic of the materialism here. I mean, he's trying to be materialistic the best he can. I don't think he gets any pleasure out of it necessarily. But I understand what they're trying to say about materialism and sort of the pointlessness of it. But that's more, to me, reflected in the people around Patrick. And all his friends.
Yeah,
the
friends.
Well-adjusted people. The successful people.
The guys that we heard at the beginning of the podcast there talking about women.
I wanted to include those people because those are the good people of the world as we exist in to a certain extent. Those are the people that are rewarded for their efforts. And
when you say good people, you mean like in sort of a capitalistic sense of the word.
Well, look, do we not live in a meritocracy? To at least some... rather sufficient. I mean, it's pretty much. I mean, you work hard,
no.
And these.
All right, Ayn Rand. I don't believe that at all. No, I'm not saying
You're taking this the wrong way. I'm saying society rewards these people for doing what they do with money.
Okay.
And I mean, you can say what you want about it, but it doesn't mean I almost more sickened not by Bateman. I mean, so much, but by the people that surround him. I find those the more sickening individuals, personally. But that's the world that Patrick grew up in, the world that was handed to him.
He's a product of nepotism.
Doing his best, yeah, he's doing his best job to imitate it because he doesn't know what else to do. He has no... His main feature of his personality is he has no empathy.
Correct. Yeah, he's an empathy-free individual.
He can't. And so the interactions that people have are... they'd make no sense to him. He just tries to imitate them the best he can. I think this is a problem that some people have who can't empathize and are maybe, you know, silver curls. They just can't see the world from... they just don't understand. The world doesn't seem to work by any sort of logic because they're missing this emotional aspect.
Well, it's not he's not a sociopathic character. He's a psychotic character because sociopaths are extremely adept at interpersonal, I guess... they're able to manipulate people on a social level, and I think because they have a pseudo empathy that they're able to deploy, where I think the Patrick Bateman character, he's just... well, there's another quote that he says, and I'm trying to find it. There is an idea of a Patrick Bateman, some kind of abstraction, but there is no real me. Only an entity, something illusory, I always get that word wrong. And though I can hide my cold gaze and you can shake my hand and feel flesh gripping yours, and maybe you can even sense our lifestyles are probably comparable, I simply am not there. So
yeah, I guess I don't see how you could be anything but wrong about saying he's psychotic but not a psychopath. I mean, he exists in his world. He's successful to a pretty good measure, even though he's the product of nepotism. He has friends. He interacts with them correctly. He responds the way they expect him to respond in many situations. And he gets people to do what he wants. You know, certainly he greases everything with plenty of cash. But he certainly is able to do things. He has a girlfriend who's just another vapid member of that social
Reese echelon. Witherspoon. Right.
And but he can't feel for them. I mean, I think his lack of ability to empathize is really the key part. And
yeah,
psychopathic people, that's one of their main problems. And we're no experts on, you know, we've talked in the past in behavioral psychology, but I'm quite certain that's one of the key features, the inability to empathize. And this character isn't able to empathize. In fact, he seems to me very much like a serial killer. To a person that can coldly interact with people to make them do what they want, as we all do, but is unable to empathize with their dreams and feelings.
Yeah. Well, when I watch American Psycho, like I said, I view Patrick Bateman as a metaphor. I don't necessarily view him because this movie is just incredibly
satirical. What is he a metaphor for, Matt? I don't really see what you're talking about. What is he a metaphor? What's the metaphor?
Well, a metaphor for basically vapid 80s consumerism. And I don't know. I watched a movie. I want to call it The Corporation? Yeah, The Corporation. It's a documentary, I think. Noam Chomsky's featured heavily in it. So in my Noam Chomsky phase, I was kind of soaking up as much as I could until I realized that Noam Chomsky is about the most boring speaker you could ever listen to. It just puts you right to sleep. He's better read strangely than listened to.
His material is so dense that I think the printed words is an easier way to consume it.
And so they talked about corporations and the legal structure that makes a corporation and how they're given the rights of what do they call them? Immortal human beings. That they and that if you took a corporation and looked at it from a legal, like if you swapped the corporation in for a human being and looked at their actions, their legal actions and you know what they do, that they would be a psychotic individual lacking of any kind of empathy. So when I look at
the Patrick character, you're saying your metaphor is he's basically a flesh and blood corporation.
Right. So he's
I never saw it that way. That's a really neat insight.
So, you know, and it's no accident that he's a Wall Street investment banker of that ilk. The name is even American Psycho. He's an American Psycho for a reason. You know, this is all about America. And I look at, you know, the 2008 financial collapse and everything that those investment banks were doing, even the ones that collapsed, and their actions are completely psychotic, lacking of any kind of empathy, exploitative. You know, they're not murdering people, but they're murdering their futures financially.
Well, sometimes they are murdering people.
And they're murdering people too. Yeah. And, the BP Deepwater Horizon disaster. If you look at the press releases from BP, it's probably, if that was actually coming from a human being who wreaked that kind of devastation on a community, it'd be just completely psychotic ramblings and half, you know, the sympathy false.
Any person who destroyed somebody's environment and then said, we're doing everything we can because we're with you. We're part of you.
Yeah, it's
and
fucked
we've
up.
Set up this $100 million fund to help businesses get their feet back underneath them.
That's so fucked up. I mean, that's just psychotic nonsense. That's evil.
It's absurd.
And
the fact that – and the way they tried to cover up their actions with their unproven techniques of using emulsifiers in enormous quantities to basically sink the oil down to the bottom – We'll be hearing about that over the next 50 years. I think we're going to be seeing some huge ramifications to their use of emulsifiers.
Right. But the thing that that documentary made the point of is that they're legally obligated to do those horrible things because their only goal is to maximize shareholder value. And if that isn't going on, then so it's pretty much, you know, damn the torpedoes. That's what they have to do, and they'll do it any which way they can. And the people involved with those corporations aren't evil. It's the legal construct that enables those corporations is a monster we created. So, you know, the Patrick Bateman character, I just see a metaphor for that. And maybe that's my own personal interpretation.
No,
maybe
I think that's a really good insight. I don't know if it catches the entirety of the Patrick character, but it certainly is a, I think you're probably right that the author, who was the author again?
Bret Easton Ellis.
I have a feeling that that's maybe was his starting point, his idea, the kernel he built this story around.
Well, he makes the point, and like we already said, that this isn't a film that is a satirical look at 80s consumerism. I don't think that's the sheen, because there's a ton of, you know, the Mean Generation infused in this, and there's 80s is a perfect decade to set this film in because, you know, it was kind of the sort of throwing away all the ideology that for good or bad that we had kind of built up over the peace and love generation of the 60s and early 70s. It was sort of it was a Reagan era, and Reagan's featured in this, you know, spouting bullshit, you know, on CNN too. So Reagan and, you know, sort of that poor people suck. There's that scene where he tells that homeless guy to get a job and that he's a loser, and then he kills him. You know, which is pretty much
It reminded me of the character in Being There, of the rich man talking about the need for people to pull them up by their bootstraps. You know,
yeah, it's that, and work. It's that typical bullshit you get from entitled Republicans who are the product of aristocracy that everybody can do what they do, which is complete and utter crap. You know,
yeah. After they give you that pep talk, which is not much of a pep talk, they should really just pull out a dagger and give you a maggot hole in your gut.
Yeah, a maggot hole. That's a good. Did you come up with that one? That's a good one.
No, that's from the Lord of the Rings movies.
Really?
There's a scene where an orc threatens somebody to put a maggot hole in them.
Ah, that makes perfect sense. Yeah. Anyway, what was I talking about? Oh, that scene. And Reagan, he actually, it's like one of those things where you know, it's kind of the reason that, like, there's a shit ton of closeted homosexual Republicans because doth do protest too much about something.
Yeah, it's a Yale thing.
And Reagan came up from poverty, and I think he hated that powerlessness of poverty so much that he hated poverty and people who were poor themselves by the time he came to office. And sort of his weird abstract rage against poor people is definitely, I mean, he built up all kinds of excuses for it. But in the 80s, it became cool to hate homeless people, which to me just is disgusting. However, there was talking points to back it up, and Reagan was the prime mover of all that bullshit. And that's one of the reasons I fucking hate Reagan. Can't spit on that guy's grave enough. You know, so.
Would you really spit on his grave, Matthew?
Well, I do have the grave peeing tour that I do at one point want to embark on, where I'm going to piss on Don Rumsfeld's grave, Dick Cheney's grave. I don't think I can get to Reagan. I think he's all, like, his sarcophagus is in some fucking library or something.
Well, no, what you do is just get some, like, first, you don't want to take your dick out in public.
Right.
First off, that's just a social no-no. Second, you don't want to use your own piss, because there's plenty of white blood cells in there, so they can genotype it and they can know whose piss it is.
Right.
You want to get like some animal piss, like some horse piss or something. Just put it in a bag with a little stop valve on the end. And when you get there, just take it out like a canteen and just squirt a little bit on there.
Yeah. Well,
and nobody's going to be the wiser. All they see is a little fluid come out of a bag.
You do get quite a bit of volume out of a horse, but I'm thinking of a more appropriate animal, like a
horse semen.
I'm thinking like pig urine.
I know what you're talking about.
All right. Anyway, so I'm going to embark on my grave desecration tour. All are welcome.
I'd be down with that. I'd be down with that. Yeah.
And for Grover Norquist, when that fat fucker dies, I'm going to throw a turd on his grave because he deserves more than piss. That's all I'm saying.
Use one of your dog's turds.
Just smear it. Smear it over the granite, you know. So the dried turd is sort of like inset into the engraving. You know, you can never really get it out. Yeah. So
I think that may be a felony.
All right. So onward.
So I think that's a really neat. So, you know, I didn't have that insight about Bateman being a human analog of a corporation. It just, you know, the one scene that sort of confuses me about the Bateman character is when he thinks he's found out. He thinks he's gone too far when he shoots those cops and
Can I say that this movie is fucking hilarious? I laughed through most of it. I mean, it's just so over the top satirical and black comedy wise that this is a really funny movie. I don't think we pointed that out, but this is one of the reasons I really enjoy American Psycho. It is really funny.
It's funny. It's real dark though.
Yeah, but it's the kind of humor I like. I don't know. Just shooting the cops unnecessarily.
How about when the car blows up? The cop car blows up, and he just looks. It's like about five beats. He just stares as he had his gun, like he can't believe his gun was a bazooka. He just doesn't understand how that car blew up from a few rounds out of his 9mm.
Or he goes into the building, and like there's just some security guard that like knows him and could care less that he's like walking through, and he just
calls
blows
him
away.
Mr. Smith.
Oh, does he? Oh, yeah. Well, that's the joke, right? He's mistaken. Marcus so and so throughout most of the film. I forget who, but
that's a point. There's a lot of mistaken identities. He gets mistaken for Jared Leto's character, Paul Allen. That's one of the main that's one of the main ways he operates. He realizes that all these people are sort of interchangeable, and his you see near the end of the film that he's mistaken for somebody else. I don't remember the name. A different person. By his lawyer, because he thinks he's a different person playing a joke that Patrick Bateman called in to some sort of murder confession. Remember? His lawyer doesn't think he thinks it's somebody else, Wilson or something.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
He's playing a big joke. And then
right,
he
thought it
anyways.
Was... Yeah, there was that... then he finds out that, you know, that call was serious, but from a psychotic mind, and then he's unnerved and dismisses himself.
Well, he's not
himself.
Really unnerved. He thinks it's just some guy named Wilson just being a dick.
Right, right.
Taking a joke too far. It's just that it doesn't... All these people are interchangeable. They're sort of empty coats to a certain extent, or an empty uniform, that it doesn't matter who you swap with who. They sort of behave the same. I don't know. Maybe he's saying that one corporation's the same as another. I don't know. Maybe
I don't know if he's going that far.
But I never really realized how important the interchangeability of characters are, and how one's just really a photocopy of another.
Well, you actually meet, you actually see the Patrick Bateman doppelganger, who does look almost exactly like him. I forget his name, Marcus. What's his last name? Anyway, but you see him, and he looks almost exactly like Patrick Bateman, except for his hair is slightly different because
that's right. He doesn't get mistaken for Paul Allen. He gets mistaken for the guy named Marcus.
Yeah, and he's right. His hair is slightly different, but he points out that his hair looks better, you know. And
they go to the same salon.
Well, and that's, I think, the point you brought up is most obvious when they're in that funny scene when they're comparing business cards. And the fucking business cards look exactly the same. And they all say vice president, you know, with the minor.
Yeah, the last name's in bold.
With the minor, and they're almost orgasmic over their cards.
I don't know if anybody else is, but Patrick is. And I think it's maybe because he puts so much importance on these superficial things because he's trying to imitate everybody else because he can't understand where they're coming from.
Well, the scene where he's fucking the hookers... And it's like the narcissism is, and he's like posing in the mirror, and looking at himself and filming himself while he's doing the chicks.
Well, I think the only way he can understand sex is through pornography.
Well,
and
that's true.
He doesn't understand any of the interpersonal dynamics that are, you know, basically the core of sexuality. All he knows is the performance. The sex is a performance act, and that's what he does. He just mimics, like he mimics everything else, he mimics the performance.
But what's funny about that scene is that his narcissism even looks fake. You know, it's just so over the top where he's like, you know, posing and stuff. And it's like that even, it looks inauthentic. It looks like.
Because it is inauthentic. He's just imitating narcissism. He's not narcissistic. He's just behaving like it because he sees it. He's just imitating it.
Which kind of sends this movie into the parody territory. I mean, it's a parody and it's a satire. I mean, it's a lot of things. I think its humor is, you know it, but it's complicated to define. At least that's kind of part of the issue with this movie, and it's probably one of the reasons
I like
sad.
It. It's sad.
The over the top. Way. Well, over the topness.
He's so pitiful. The Patrick character. Even though he likes to kill women, you know, in his mind, right. He's really sort of a pitiful individual. He just has no connection with anybody, and he can't. It's just sad. It must be a terrible existence for him.
Well, I don't really believe he's a real character the way we think of relating to actual real film characters. Like I keep going back to the metaphor, the caricature, you know, he even at the beginning that quote I pointed out, he basically says that he is a hollow shell. And so to me, it's more abstraction. I don't really set out to relate to Patrick Bateman at all when I watch this.
Do you have some sort of problem empathizing with other humans, Matt?
Maybe. I did.
I don't know. I think there's that was a joke. I think.
No, I know.
I think there are people who are like this. I think a lot of serial killers are really like this. They're just terribly tortured aliens on this planet. And I don't know why violence is somehow a product of this alienness. I don't get it.
It could be what they call a function of the behavioral sink. I don't know. There's this whole theory.
I don't know. We really need to get a behavioral psychologist in on this.
Yeah. I'm sure they're all over the place.
You know, but that would give us so much insight to see what
my last landlord was a behavior says. My last landlord was a behavioral psychologist, but he only really seemed interested in fucking divorcees. So I don't know if he would have been
a behavior I can get behind.
Yeah, he was skeezy. I don't know. He was divorced, and every chick he'd bring by, because I lived in a blue duplex and he lived underneath, and every chick he'd bring by, they were all these kind of, I don't know, sad divorcees. They're kind of good looking, but there would be like a new one every month. I don't know. I don't know where. Psychology, man. I think that field is chock full of gals.
I mean, that would probably be a blast.
If you really want to meet chicks in college, psychology and art history, those are the two fields I would say going
with.
Well,
you probably make more money at psychology.
I don't know. Yeah, art history, I think nobody's making any money there.
Well, I can't blame him for wanting to get busy.
He did, but he was really skeezy. I don't know. There's something. What's the male version of a skank? I know it's a douchebag, but he wasn't a douche. He was just kind of, he was thin and narrow shouldered and sort of slimy.
I would call that the average American male, I think, is the.
No way, man. He wasn't a real man. I'll say that. I don't know
What is a man?
He just didn't score high on the man level. Man? I don't know. Broad shoulders make you more of a man than a narrow-shouldered man. I'm just going to say that. I don't trust narrow-shouldered guys.
And balls.
Giant, huge balls.
No. That's a Big Lebowski asks the dude, what makes a man?
Balls. Is that true? Could you be wienerless and still have balls?
Absolutely. I think we covered the idea of in the crying game of what you display to the world, what the image is the gender you are, not any.
Please reference podcast number, I forget, 50-something. I forget where that we did
is
that
it?
One.
But
yeah,
it's so. One of our better ones.
Okay. So so you're sympathizing with Patrick Bateman. You find him a sad, pitiable character.
Well, I think of the times I've killed prostitutes. And
you had that phase.
I see a lot of echoes.
Yeah, that phase.
So I guess it's sympathizing because you can't empathize. Well, you know, you felt alienated before. You've seen people's behaviors and you don't understand why people are behaving the way they are. This happens in high school. So you just sort of imitate it and you say you'll figure it out later.
Well, the thing about Patrick Bateman is he fits in too well. He's
very good imitator.
He's like in the popular in crowd and he fits in so well that people can't even differentiate him from the other, you know, douchebags. He's like, it's almost the, the curse of the popular crowd. Like he has no individuality. He fits in so well. And when he says crazy off-putting shit, people don't even, it doesn't even register on their radar, you know, and just like that, that scene at the beginning where, you know, he stops the conversation, you know. It's like that one moment where he sort of breaks the rules of the guy talk and just sort of like makes his mark and they all like going, holy shit, you know, that's a little too far. We'll go ahead and objectify women and, you know, all that stuff. But, yeah, we're not going to go that far, you know. So
we're not going to put their head on a spike. that's the point. He's an amazing imitator. He's a beautiful imitation of a man. He's lovely.
Yeah, no, that's...
But it doesn't mean he's not an imitation. I mean, I've seen some nice imitation leather, you know, handbags and whatnot, or imitation furs that are... They feel wonderful. They look beautiful. They might as well be the real thing, but it doesn't mean they're not an imitation. Just because you're very good at imitating doesn't mean you're not.
So, okay, so if I view this film as a metaphor, what did you take away from this movie? What did you feel its message was? Besides the fact that I think it's humorous and entertaining, but, you know.
Well, it's certainly very entertaining, and it's a fun watch, and the hour 45 minutes really fly by in this film. This is one of those weird movies that goes over 90 minutes that I don't go, maybe we should take about 5 or 10 out of this son of a bitch. This movie moves. This movie rocks. It uses all hour 45 minutes. What do I take from this movie other than the enjoyment of the viewing? I guess a disdain for the upper classes, but I already had that, so it doesn't really change that. I mean, the perversion of the meritocracy, you know, or the perversion that happens when you have a pure meritocracy without socialism mixed in.
Well, these kids are all entitled Ivy Leaguers with powerful parents. Yeah, and
they're all like 10 years younger than me, and I feel like, God, man, I really...
Yeah. Patrick Bateman's
I really should have smoked less pot in my 20s.
Now, see, that's and you're buying into the lie, I would say.
It's my fault. It's my own.
Not good enough. Picked your sorry ass up by your bootstraps and gotten that MBA, you could be, high power man by now.
Oh, you know, I really shouldn't have turned down that Harvard acceptance letter I got. I just didn't think I was good enough.
There was this article I read in Rolling Stone. It was... about Dartmouth fraternities, and this one guy who basically he was in this fraternity with basically a bunch of the clones that you see there in this movie, and talking about really how those people get jobs on Wall Street like that. The fraternity is sort of a collection point for entitled, powerful, rich white kids, but he basically laid all the hazing rituals out there. He just described them all, which I guess is verboten. I mean, that's like a more tightly kept secret than Area 51 amongst fraternities, and I guess they don't cop to it. But no, he just went out there and said these guys are basically a bunch of fucking knuckle dragging barbarians who like to torture their fellow brothers, and the reward is that you get hooked up with a Wall Street job as an analyst, quote unquote, where you gamble with other people's money, and you can win big, and if you lose, then the system will pad you, and that's pretty much what.
Well,
we
you
saw.
Get another job later, and you won't face any jail time or any sort of monitoring.
Right, you don't face any jail time. You know, like if you look
you
at all,
you don't get
the,
as nice of a golden parachute. It'll be more of like a sterling silver parachute.
If you look at all the, you know, assholes that got off scot-free after the 2008 financial collapse. Yeah. None of them suffered, you know. The worst is they had to move into, like, one of their town homes and, you know, sell off the second one. But, yeah, none of them had any penalties or consequences behind any of their...
You hear that, you sons of bitches? Matt Rivette's going to come and get
coming
you.
Coming after you, President of AIG.
I'm just getting a Woody thinking about your head on a spike. Actually, that would sort of probably give me a little bit of a Woody.
If you had, like, if you unleashed a horde of Vikings from the 8th century into Wall Street and you just said, bring forth their heads and have investment bankers being slaughtered ritualistically in the streets.
Not a tear was shed that day.
Can you think about how much of, like, Roman style bloodlust the American people would have if we took all those rich assholes out? It's like when a private Gulfstream crashes. Who fucking sheds a tear over that? You know, I mean,
that's what I'm saying. We got to find those crazy guys that shoot up movie theaters and grade schools and fucking send them down to Wall Street. Just have them fucking mow through one of those high rise buildings, video game style.
I think they did that, and it was called 9/11, but I'm just saying.
Man, that was an inside job. in a way, you're sort of right.
Well,
oh my God.
All
of a sudden, I understand Osama bin Laden, and I sort of see his point. That's weird, man. You've really opened my eyes here.
Well, after 2008, boy, this is blasphemy.
Why we really didn't care that much about 9/11. I didn't really care that much about it, other than the fact that we used it as a pretense to go to two wars, and going through security is a bigger pain in the ass.
No. Well, there was lots of people who did, believe me. For every, like, maybe one hedge fund manager that really had it coming, there was like 10 people who absolutely didn't have it coming. Janitors, secretaries, you know.
Acceptable losses, you mean?
Acceptable losses. Passengers on airliners. Yeah. So
we're going to lose viewers over this.
Oh,
discussion.
My God. We're going to get hate mail. Hate mail.
I hope we get some hate mail.
Oh, anyway. But I don't know. So, wow. I stepped in it. I don't know. I feel controversial here. I got controversial all of a sudden. Son of a bitch.
Well, it's controversial because it's true. I really don't really give a bitch.
Well, I don't. If people were to drop dead from some horrible disease, the people that I would feel least sorry for are all the goons on Wall Street who have been robbing and stealing us from the American people for the past, I don't know, you know, for the Greenspan era, as I like to call it, and fucking getting away with it. And you know, every time I see Martha Stewart, I just get pissed off. I'm like, how the fuck did Martha Stewart go to prison when all these other goddamn pirates of investment walk scot-free? None of them are going to the clink. Nobody went to jail after
the 2008
finals.
She didn't play Ookie Cookie with all the good old boys.
Oh, my God. I view her, I want to call her martyr, Saint Martha the Martyr. It's fucking ridiculous why she went to
prison. God, she's such an annoying bitch, though.
I know. She could have been a little bit more, if she was just a little bit more likable.
That's a good thing.
I don't know. And then when Elliot Spitzer, you know, because he had an affair, and then he went down, and he was like the only guy going after those assholes. And I don't know. I felt sorry for him.
Well, look, the one thing we can be sure of is that none of these Wall Street guys are flying in high class cookers to fuck. Be sure of that, right?
Well, they're not doing what? What are you saying?
They're not flying any high class hookers into New York to fuck.
No.
That's what Elliot Spitzer did. That was his crime.
Oh no, I thought he was doing that down in D.C.
He brought hookers across state lines. That was this felony.
Well, that's a felony?
That's what brought him down. Yeah, I don't think he was ever charged, but I think that bringing a sex worker across state lines is some sort of human trafficking.
I didn't even know. And then murdering them a la Patrick Bateman style?
No, that doesn't really matter. That's more of a state issue.
Okay, one thing I'd like to comment on, and one of the things I found most funny about American Psycho is his commentary about 80s pop music. Just fucking, I just got fucking kick out of.
I know it's funny. This is, you know, the way he talks about it, it's like he's reading a memorized review. He's saying something that he doesn't understand.
Well, like that. I wish he had the drop.
Why is he so fixated on music?
I wish he had the drop. But do you like Phil Collins? I've been a big Genesis fan ever since the release of their 1980 album Duke. Before that, I really didn't understand any of their work. Too artsy, too intellectual. It was on Duke where Phil Collins presents himself, where presence became more apparent. I think Invisible Touch was the group's undisputed masterpiece, which is hilarious because if you look at any true Genesis fan, they're basically going to dismiss all the the Peter Gabriel free era of Genesis when Phil Collins did take over, you know, and we'll all say that like the Lamb Lies Down in Broadway is the Genesis finest work, which is the artsy 70s era of Genesis, you know. So it's like he knows everything about Genesis. It's like somebody was carrying on about how awesome Van Halen was, and then he said, well, what's your favorite album? And they were like, oh, 5150 with Sammy Hagar, you know. I mean, it's it just cracks me up that, you know.
Oh, you know, I guess I didn't really see that because I've never really listened to Genesis. So you're saying those words he spoke, which sound like he was reading, or it sounded like he was playing a cassette tape of him reading from a script. Do you think those were his actual views? Because they didn't make any sense because he can't empathize. He just can't feel those feelings.
Oh, I thought it was just funny shit to put in the movie. I thought it was
funny, but it was it.
Well, he's just.
They were somebody else's words coming out of his mouth.
Maybe.
Even though they were stupid words on top of being funny.
Maybe, but like he goes on about Huey Lewis, who is like probably the most vapid musician of the 80s if there ever was one, you know.
It's a little too black for me.
Wait, black? You're too dark? You're talking Huey about Lewis. Huey Lewis? He's still
that's a line from the movie. He says it when he's being interviewed by the private detective. And private detective brings out news. He goes, you ever listen to this? And he goes, no. You know, it's too black.
Too black? You mean like too...
it's too ethnic.
Huey Lewis in the news.
Too bluesy.
Wait, Huey Lewis? Oh, I didn't catch
that. That's what he said.
That's fucking hilarious. You missed this,
but it's a pretty funny line.
Because I think Huey Lewis was dismissed as probably the whitest band on the planet, you know.
Yeah
That guy was I'm trying to think of a 90s equivalent. Well, it's like jock rock, you know. That's I think one of Huey Lewis's albums was called Sports,
you yeah know? Sports, that was a big one. And Four, right? Was the other one Four?
Oh my god, yeah. I mean, he painted a whole disdainful picture.
Look, I had Sports on cassette tape.
Were you like, did you like listening to I Want a New Drug? You know,
that was, it was probably one of those high school albums. You know, you have a few things on cassette tapes. I was never that into music.
It was really all downhill for Huey Lewis when he released Happy to Be Stuck with You. I remember that really annoyed me, that video. But anyway, I don't know. I got a total kick out of that, especially when he would interrupt his discussion of Phil Collins to tell the hookers to, like, you know, do stuff.
He had sort of a plan for the night. He really liked his world very orderly.
Yeah, well.
But, the music stuff was really funny. I think you have more insight since.
I don't know. Well, Phil Collins is, he has some kind of neurological disorder now that doesn't allow him to perform. I don't know what it is. But,
oh, really?
In the 80s, he was like, well, he's like the preeminent 80s musician. The dorky white guy who, you know, when Top 40 was ruled by the white man back there in the 80s, he was top of the heap. And, his power ballads, like I think they even get mentioned in this, you know, In the Air Tonight and Against All Odds, you know, that was... he was right up there with Duran Duran as far as sort of signifying the era. But strangely, a weird note about Phil Collins. Hip-hop guys fucking love Phil Collins.
Really?
I've never been able to figure that one out. Yeah. There's even kind of a nod to that in The Hangover where Mike Tyson's like grooving on In the Air Tonight, you know?
Oh, yeah.
I don't know what it is.
I guess I didn't see that. You know, it's funny you should mention Phil Collins being sick, because Peter Gabriel also has a neurological disorder.
Really? I didn't know.
It causes him to only be interested in world music.
Oh, they call it the Wilmad disease.
It's very sad. It's very sad.
Oh, my God. That means you have to have like a backup of South African singers at all times to, man.
Yeah, and it's tough. It's tough, but he's, you know, he's doing the best he can.
I think Paul Simon suffers from that, too.
I think so, yeah. I think it might be communicable.
Shit, who's gonna come down with it next? Justin Timberlake? I mean, who's next on the line?
It could be anybody, and that's the real tragedy.
Okay, all right. All right, we're creeping up on the hour here, so do we want to get into the Ebert review on this?
All right, well, Ebert reviewed this film when it came out on April 14th of the year 2000. He liked the film, giving it 3 out of 4 stars, which is generally, you know, he gives 3s to good movies. So he talks about, first he starts out talking about the director, Mary Harron. He says she transformed a novel about bloodlust into a movie about men's vanity. He says the director sees the main character, Patrick, as a guy who's prey to the usual male drives and compulsions, which means he's the prey of those drives and compulsions. She takes a little bit more of a, you know, in a direction that he talks about, at least in a direction that we didn't talk about, is why this movie is more of a criticism about the American male, which I think is really important.
Yeah, we didn't get into the gender issue. To me, it seemed obvious.
He talks about it a lot here, and I think he makes some good points. So if it's okay, I'll just kind of bust through it here. He says, most men are not chainsaw killers. They only act that way while doing business. He says, look at the traders clawing each other on the floor of the stock exchange and consider the joy with which one megacorp stock raids another and dumps its leaders. He says, study such films as Glengarry Glen Ross or Boiler Room.
We did Glengarry Glen Ross.
We were talking about the megacorp. Mm-hmm. He says, Harron, the director, is less impressed by the vile Patrick Bateman than a man might have been. Perhaps because as a woman who directs movies, she deals every day with guys who resemble Bateman in all but his body count. I think that's a really neat insight. It's stuff that is sort of a position that I have trouble empathizing with because I'm not a woman. But I think that, to a case, you know, dealing with sort of sexism in the workplace is a real pain in the ass. And you can see where she would certainly have some criticisms of sort of the male dog-eat-dog world of business or of movie making.
Right.
Let me see here. He says about Patrick, he is a narcissist driven by ego and fueled by greed. Most of his victims are women, but in a pinch, a man will do. And I have to say, is Jared Leto really a man? He's a little too
pretty. Girly. I don't know. He has those baby blue eyes. Soft.
Is that the only
eyes.
Man he kills? Oh, he kills those cops and stuff.
He kills the hobo or the bum. Kills that guy.
Oh yeah, he does kill the hobo. That's a good point. He says the film regards the male executive lifestyle with the devotion of a fetishist. I thought that was
pretty close. Like
that. That's a good description. And, you know, he talks about the business card scene, which you talked about. And he talks about their rivalries where they use clothes and being able to get good tables in important restaurants as the sort of signifiers of this competition, and which is why he kills Leto, Jared Leto's character. Because he keeps getting reservations easily at, I forget the restaurant's name, but it must be the most exclusive
Dorsey
place.
Or the Dorsey or something like that.
Something like that. But Dorsia, it's a place
Dorsia.
He can't get a reservation at.
Yeah.
And he talks a little bit about the elements of fantasy in this movie. He says, whether some of the murders are fantasies, all of the murders are equally real and unreal, or unreal. And that isn't the point. He says, it's more of a way to visualize the frenzy of a territorial male when his will is frustrated. The movie gives shape and form to things such as rose rays or domestic abuse. It's pretty interesting. I sort of had a road rage incident yesterday.
Really? You kind of get ragey on the road.
As road
rage,
it's a real blast. It really gets you excited.
Until somebody gets hurt. Until somebody gets hurt. Then it's
not a blast. It wasn't really a situation when anybody could get hurt because we weren't actually moving in the vehicles. We were stationary.
Okay.
I was trying to get out of the parking lot at SeaTac yesterday because I was coming in from out of state. And I had a coupon that got me like $30 off like the 6 days of parking in the parking lot.
Yeah.
And they only had, of all the pay lines, they only had one which was a cashier that could take the fucking coupon. Okay. So I'm in this line. It's like about 10 cars long and cars are going through. And then I'm like five cars back. Somebody literally gets stuck up at the cashier for like 10 minutes.
Fuck. I don't know what's going on up there.
You hand the person your credit card. What you the hand fuck's them that the coupon. You hand them the ticket. They run it. You're out of there in about 30 seconds.
Yeah. Those are up there for 10 mind. Minutes. Like what's and going I, on know, there?
And I didn't really get mad, but I was a little rummy from a long flight and being up for a long time. And I just started honking my horn like crazy. And actually rolled down my window one time and yelled out, "What the fuck is going on up there?"
Good for you, man. I applaud that.
I don't know if it's good. It didn't really change anything. After 10 minutes, the car moved on and we moved through and I was just the asshole.
Whatever.
But it's sort of a neat feeling. I think it's a masculine thing.
I've owned that.
And the reason I had that, I acted out, is because I was frustrated.
I don't know if that's a male. Well, maybe it's a male thing. Raging.
I think it is.
I think it's
a male thing. Yeah.
Yeah, we didn't really touch on the whole male-centric point of this movie, which is I think it was so obvious.
That's what Ebert's talking about. I think it flew over our heads largely because we're guys.
Maybe it's just so glaringly obvious.
As it was feminism, they can view masculinity from outside, and I think whenever you step outside of a system to view it, you really get the clearest view. Speaking about feminism, he says, you can see why Herron, the director, is called the film feminist. And so it is. And a libel against many sane, calm, and civilized men that it does not describe. I don't know about that. I have a hard time calling men civilized. They do a good impression of it. It sees Bateman and despises him. And then he lauds Christian Bale for his performance, where he has no instinct for self-preservation.
I'm going to bring a little insight into...
Well, that's all I have to say about that.
Okay. A little insight. It marries up to what you were saying about Ebert's review. But the origins of Patrick Bateman is interesting. Looking for a way to create the character of Patrick Bateman, Christian Bale stumbled onto a Tom Cruise appearance on David Letterman. According to American Psycho director Mary Herron, Bale saw in Cruise this very intense friendliness with nothing behind the eyes, and Bale subsequently based the character of Bateman on that. Interestingly, Tom Cruise is actually featured in the novel. He lives in the same apartment complex as Bateman, who meets him in a lift and gets the name of cocktail wrong, calling it bartender.
Fascinating.
Yeah, there's a lot
real clear.
There's a lot of meat there, especially when you get into, I mean, there's the whole Scientology thing, which I've ranted about in previous podcasts, but the most intriguing thing is Tom Cruise's, how he interviewed, quote unquote, for his next wife after Nicole Kidman, like through the Church of Scientology. But it was almost an interview process that he undertook and coordinated by church folks. It just seems so bizarre, like so psychopathic and empty, you know. I don't know. When you kind of marry up Tom Cruise to Patrick Bateman, and that's kind of the impetus for the mannerisms and the character that Christian Bale used, it's pretty thought-provoking. It definitely gives you sort of an anchor.
What sort of makes Tom Cruise sort of frightening and unsettling individual when you see him. Sort of gives me the creeps. He makes the hair on the back of my neck stand up.
I think I got to find that Letterman interview.
I like that friendliness with empty eyes. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
That's really disturbing.
Anyway, but yeah, that was a good review. It definitely brought up things that we didn't really focus on, but are extremely apropos. You know, just about, I guess, I liked it. Well, and he does mention, Ebert does mention the business card scene, and where they're comparing their business cards almost like phallus, says, you know, like whipping them out and showing each other and measuring them up and stuff. So,
yeah, and then there's the scene where they're in the bathroom sewing each other their penises, too. Oh, no, they're doing drugs.
The scene in the club where they're all in the stall. It's like, shut up, I'm trying to do drugs here. And then, like, they're snorting, and I think it's like, oh, this is just sugar, but they keep snorting it anyway. And I don't know, this movie's really comical. It hit me right. It's definitely different than the comedy we reviewed last week, but it's still, I think, is a pretty funny movie. I found myself laughing. And maybe it's a little bit of when you laugh at things that are embarrassing as you don't really know what else to do, you know, that kind of laughter.
Well, they're unsettling, and laughter's, I mean, yeah. The animal reason of laughter is to let the people around you know that everything's all right, even though there's something that could be disturbing or unsettling going on.
Right.
In the world, or something incongruous is happening. And it's, well, they say it's sort of an instinctual sound you make to let other members of your group know that it's nothing to worry about. It's not serious.
Yeah.
So nobody gets too crazy and does something weird. And so right. Certainly unsettling or disturbing things that aren't real is certainly a cue, I think, in your old brain to laugh.
Yeah, maybe. All right. So I think I don't know. Anything else we want to say about American Psycho? Any details?
No, it's a good movie. It's a hell of a film. It's a fun watch on top of everything else.
So next week, I haven't seen this movie. You have.
Well, we haven't done a Kurosawa film yet. And maybe this is just sort of a weird choice to be the first Kurosawa film to do.
Seemed a little odd.
Next week is my cycle where I pick a movie I've seen and I've enjoyed, and then I think you probably enjoy too.
Okay.
It's a time for me to choose a feel-good movie, maybe like The Big Lebowski or something. And in this case, I'm seeing a movie that I saw in the theater. I think it got re-released around 2000 or so. I saw it in the theater. It's Der Suuzala. It's a 1975 film by Kurosawa, as I've said before. And it's actually a interesting Russian/Japanese co-production. For some reason, Kurosawa had some sort of fascination with with the Russians. Well, I guess they've always had sort of a
interesting relationship. They were at war with each other.
Yeah, since after World War II, peace was also a peace with the Soviet Union. And so this has a story of the far east of Russia, which is a huge, you know, huge landmass.
It's like most of it.
And the government from the east sends out expeditions to explore this area, and just I think the idea is that they're exerting their control over the entire landmass. Anyways, this follows the story of it's more of a survey team, but it also has soldiers in it, and they're out surveying, and they run across a local guy, which is sort of East Asian descent, you know, the whole Mongol type.
Yeah.
And anyways, this character's name is Der Suuzala, and the leader of this sort of expedition and Der Su form a relationship, and the movie's about their relationship over a pretty good span of time. It's beautiful. Fucking beautiful scenery, it's a real touching film on top of that.
And lots of boobs, which is...
And it's sort of West meets East. You know, the civilization of the West meets more of a rural civilization.
Lots
of East. It's pretty fascinating.
Dick and fart jokes. It'll definitely keep up the tempo.
There is a couple of fart jokes.
Yeah, oh, man. Yeah, you got to have those.
I love my fart jokes.
Kurosawa is nothing without his fart joke repertoire. I mean, come on.
It's basically this movie's a series of sketches sort of loosely weaved together by sort of a subpar storyline.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Until next week.
I think you'll like it.
All right. No, I like Kurosawa. I've seen three or four of his films. They're kind of big meals. I don't know if I would revisit most of them, but they're definitely I've seen Magnificent Seven, Throne of Blood, and Ran of the Samurai Epics. And I saw Dreams, which is a little different. But anyway, I'm looking forward to it. And like I said, always good for dick and fart jokes, those films. So until next week.
We're not through yet.